My castaway this week is an actor. Still only 36, he's one of a highly successful group of performers who came via Cambridge and the Footlights to the London stage and television. He's probably best known for his partnership with Stephen Fry, playing the idiotic Bertie Wooster opposite Fry's Jeeves for ITV, and starring with him in their comedy series for the BBC. But his versatility and originality extend well beyond that. He's rowed for Cambridge in the boat race, can play almost any musical instrument he wants, and has just written his first novel. None of this seems to make him happy. If a thing's worth doing, he once said, it's worth getting absolutely miserable about. He is Hugh Laurie. You're obviously, by the sound of it, Hugh, one of life's worriers.
This is a gross understatement. I suppose I am, yes. I find happiness, I get uncomfortable with happiness. I think if things are going too well, I start to worry, you know.
So you worry about every part
you do? Yeah.
Everything, your writing, anything?
I could worry about the colour scheme of this room. I could, absolutely everything.
Why do we imagine, then, why do we perceive you as being kind of relaxed, witty, urban? And Stephen Fry, too, actually, of course, who turns out to be a great worrier.
Yes, I don't know. You know, of course I get lots of pleasure from performing. I'm trying to think when I got lots of pleasure from performing, but there must have been times.
But what do you worry about? You're worrying about not being up to scratch, eh?
Yes, absolutely.
That. All the time?
All the time.
And is that
about someone just saying fraud, you know, calling out from the crowd, oi, where do you think you're going?
Has it got worse with success? You know, I mean, the greater your reputation, the higher you've got to strive to keep it up.
Well, it got worse in one very swift step when I decided to do it for a living. I used to get a great amount of pleasure out of performing at school and university, you know, as an amateur. I used to have a lot of confidence. I used to think, I know I can do this. I can stand on a stage with virtually nothing and no idea what I'm going to say or do, and it will be all right. I can make it work. And as soon as I started doing it for a living, it all changed. I don't know why. And one of the strange things that happened was that I had always thought of audiences as being female in character. And when I started to do it professionally, for some reason they became male. And they became competitive. They became an adversary that had to be conquered. And I imagined rows of men with their arms folded saying, go on then, go on then. And I used to get very aggressive about audiences. And Stephen and I, we'd both come off stage going, those, oh, God, ooh. You know, we would absolutely seethe with rage. And if we felt we hadn't triumphed.
So is there nothing at all in your professional life that gives you pleasure?
Finishing things. I love to finish things. Almost any amount of pain is worth the pleasure of coming off stage or finishing writing something that's caused you a lot of grief. It's the banging the head against the brick wall. It's so nice when you stop.
So it's a beautiful moment until the judgments roll in.
That's right.
No judgments on a desert island. Presumably you'll be happy to escape to one.
Very happy, indeed. My wife is rather worried about how happy I would be. I think I have an extremely intense fantasy life, I'm afraid. In fact, it's too intense in some ways. It's almost debilitating. It actually stops me from doing things because I'm able to fantasise so accurately about what it would be like to win Wimbledon or be the Prime Minister or climb Everest that I actually never bother to try and do any of these things.
So you can sit on your island and do it. Tell me about the first record.
The first record is Muddy Waters. I have to confess, I could quite happily have chosen 8 Muddy Waters records. He is the musician who I have listened to most of in my life and has meant the most to me. It's very difficult to choose one. I've gone for a track called I Want to Be Loved. Your voice is like an angel above. The touch of your hand, woman, drives me insane. But baby, I want to be loved.
Wants to be loved. Muddy Waters and I Want to Be Loved. I said that you're probably best known for your Bertie Wooster portrayal, although I dare say some people would argue that your roles in Blackadder rather put you on the map. But tell me about Jeeves and Wooster, Hugh. Was there ever any doubt which Fry and Laurie would play which Jeeves or Wooster?
Not in our minds, no. It seemed pretty obvious, really, that Stephen has a wiser countenance, I think. He is a sort of darker, more authoritative look.
But he could play an upper-class twit, couldn't he?
Yes.
Could you play a a solemn sage, I suppose.
Oh, heck, you're saying he could play both and I could only play one. Oh.
Ah, there goes the inferiority complex.
Yes.
But I suppose, yes, it was obvious. He's got the dark brown voice.
The dark brown voice, exactly.
Whatever,
and he's an inch and a bit taller and, you know, generally more imposing, I think.
And he's older than you and he's richer than you and
yes.
All those things.
All those things.
Had you always been a Woodhouse fan?
I came to Jeeves and Wooster pretty late, in fact, but had always absolutely adored Woodhouse. And therefore, we were extremely nervous about taking on something as loved as Woodhouse. I mean, he has such a fanatical following.
And also because Dennis Price and Ian Carmichael were very much set in the nation's mind as
absolutely.
Being Jeeves.
Although that was 20-something years before, but even so, it had still remained in people's minds as definitive.
And apparently it didn't go down well in America, which is strange.
It
really,
went tremendously well with critics, but the Americans didn't really go for it. I think it was it's too verbal, really. I mean, one has to remember that we are divided by a common language. And to the average American audience, I think, you know, get in the car, that's a line. That's a line they can understand, get in the car, or I'll blow your brains out, or whatever it may be. But, sir, I shall endeavour to effect a burglarious entry. It may as well be Swahili to them. I think they actually do not hear it. They can't actually understand it.
But they managed with Upstairs, Downstairs. That was hugely popular, wasn't it?
Yes, that's sort of... Yes. There are people going, my darling, and kissing each other. I suppose more melodramatic in a way. I'm no expert on Upstairs, Downstairs. Yes, all right, OK, so they loved Upstairs. Why didn't they like us then? I thought I got away with that.
Because you weren't any good, you
that's
see.
That's right.
It's terribly good. That's four series, are there going to be any more?
No, there aren't, unfortunately. A variety of reasons. I started to go bald. That was pretty galling in the fourth series.
Have you?
No, well, I'm quite tall, you see. I get away with it most of the time. But somebody had to swoop in before takes and sort of dust my pate, which is we felt was sort of inappropriate for Bertie somehow. And also we had gone through the stories so quickly, having dispensed with the narrative voiceover and having reduced the novels really to plots, a lot of which, it has to be said, repeat themselves. We had ripped through them so quickly that there wasn't a lot left, actually. We had filleted the oeuvre. That's rather a pleasing phrase. We'd filleted the oeuvre pretty quickly.
Record number two.
This is the opening of, now I don't even know how to say this, it doesn't come up very often now that I have to say it, Bruch, I've never known. It's a violin concerto in G minor. It's partly to show that I'm cultured, although I'm not actually cultured, I'm a raw Philistine. But this is one of the few pieces of classical music that I could countenance on a desert island. It's just an absurdly romantic piece, and I love it.
Part of Bruch's Violin Concerto No. 1, played by Pinchas Zukerman with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Zubin Mehta. Do you play the violin, Hugh?
Oddly enough, I don't. No.
I thought you played all instruments.
No, I don't know where you got that from. That's absolutely
true. How many instruments do you play?
I trifle at a number. It's the piano and the guitar and, just a few things.
Did you play in the school orchestra?
I did, yes. I played the percussion in the school orchestra. And from that experience, I grew to hate violinists a great deal, actually, I'm afraid. Violinists en masse. I used to think of them, because I stood at the back with my cymbals and my triangle, and they were the sort of gauleiters down the front who used to snigger at the conductor's jokes, and I grew to hate them, I really do, and I sort of...
They were superior.
They were very superior, yes. Violin as a solo instrument, I adore. But en masse, I think of these ranks of people in white short-sleeved shirts. I don't know what that means.
Was this at the Dragon School in Oxford, or was it at Eton?
This was at Eton, yeah.
Your father was a GP in Oxford.
Yes.
And you had a brother, have a brother and yes. two sisters. Where did you come in the pecking order of it all? I mean, you were the youngest.
I was the youngest, yes. Well, I suppose it's the fate of many families, siblings anyway, to think that they are the least favourite. My sisters and brother would firmly argue that I was the blue-eyed boy who could do no wrong and that I irritated them greatly for that reason.
Were you much younger than them?
I was quite a bit younger, yes. My brother's the next oldest and he's 6 years older than me. But, of course, I didn't see it that way at the time. I don't suppose anybody does, really.
So describe yourself to me as a boy of 10. What were you like?
Unpleasant, I suspect. Idle, feckless. Quite happy. Happy because I do, as I said, I have this very vivid sort of fantasy life. I was a great, and still am, a great fantasist. And I spent a large amount of time on my own.
Did you then have the ability to make people laugh?
I can remember my family, I always thought, were very... I can remember laughing more than I can remember making people laugh. My father and mother and sisters and brother, always thought of as being tremendously funny. I can remember meals were very enjoyable because we did used to laugh a lot. And I suppose that by sort of 10, I started to give as good as I got, as it were.
What did you expect to do with your life? What ideas did you have of becoming what?
I considered medicine briefly. I never worked hard enough to pass the exams to become a doctor. But I had a period of seriously considering the Hong Kong police. In the mid-70s, there was a big recruitment drive. This could be completely wrong, but this is how I remember it. And there were brochures. In fact, I sent off for the brochures of young men in Land Rovers with creases down the front of their shorts and shiny peaked caps. And it seemed to me a terribly sort of glamorous and exciting life.
You like the khaki uniform?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you like the idea of showing your knees. Somebody told me you were a special constable. That can't be true.
No, that's absolutely not true. And I don't know how that rumour gained ground. I once made a citizen's arrest. That may have qualified me for that.
So you're a good law-abiding chap. And apparently a bit of a square at Eton. Is that right?
Yeah, I suppose so. I think I became square, yes. I mean, I was quite bad at 15, 16. I was nearly thrown out. And I had a ghastly traumatic meetings with my parents. They came and had to take me away and give me a talking to at a service station on the M4. Which I can never drive past now without thinking of, with shame and embarrassment. But then by the end of it, I suppose I'd become square. I became a sort of house captain and that sort of... yes, I became establishment. Oh, God. I'm so sorry.
Tell me about record number 3.
It's Tumbling Dice by the Rolling Stones. This is a record. When I was about 10, I tried to make a petrol bomb. And I burnt myself rather badly, which was a just punishment for being so idiotic. And... while I was convalescing, instead of my father actually never got particularly cross about the petrol bomb, which he had every right to, but he went into Woolworths and he said, have you got a pop record? He bought me, they gave him Tumbling Dice by the Rolling Stones, and I probably played it 1,000 times while I was getting better. To this day, I've imagined this picture of him braving the hit parade to ask for this record, and I thought I was just so touched by it as a gesture, and it means a great deal to me for that reason.
The Rolling Stones and Tumbling Dice. A quick bit of boat race here, I think, Hugh. What year, what number, what was the result?
The year was 1980. I was number 4 in this particular encounter, and the result was a loss by Cambridge by a distance of 5 feet, which is something which I will take to my grave.
So do you still dream about the 5 feet?
I do, actually.
You fantasise about winning.
I do. In fact, I shouldn't really say this because I wouldn't want, still to this day, wouldn't want to give any pleasure or satisfaction to the opposing crew for that reason. But yes, it is true. It was a very bitter defeat.
So there you were, reading anthropology at Cambridge, a member of Footlights. At what point did you meet Stephen Fry and how?
That was my last year. I was president of Footlights. The responsibility was mine to assemble a review for the end of the year. I was absolutely determined that it should be very grown up in that sort of very pompous sort of 20-year-old way. Some of the previous reviews had been very sprightly young undergraduates sort of nipping about the stage, and that had rather nauseated me, so I wanted to do something rather sick, in fact. And I chose Stephen. Not for the sickness reason, but because he appeared then. He appears slightly younger now, but he appeared then to be about 60. He very nearly wore sort of stiff collars, and he's dressed younger and younger as he's got older. He'll be in short trousers in about 10 years' time.
While you go bald.
Yes, quite.
So it was his gravitas that was important
exactly.
to you.
Yeah.
That was what attracted you to him in the first place. Did you know immediately that you'd found a professional soulmate?
Not a professional soulmate, because I hadn't really considered it as a profession, but we got on very well, very quickly, and when we started to write together, we made each other laugh a lot. It seemed to come very easily. We would just churn out great piles of stuff.
You wrote the Cellar Tapes together,
yes.
Or most of it, didn't you?
Yeah,
well, the whole show.
Yes, a fair bit of it, yes. Mm.
And it won the Perrier Award at the Fringe.
It did.
And then it got onto the telly. What was it about? Because I don't remember it at all.
Well, it was a loose assemblage of sketches and comic moments of varying degrees of success. We were extremely lucky because Not the 9 o'clock News was a great success, and very quickly other television companies were desperately scrabbling to get their own version of it. So suddenly, young people doing sketch comedy became a very sought after product. It's such an awful word, but anyway, that's probably how television executives would describe it. And we were sort of caught up in that scrabbling.
Record number four.
Record number four is Frank Sinatra with Count Basie, because, Sinatra I love anyway. Count Basie's orchestra is about as good a collection of musicians as ever got together. And this is Love is the Tender Trap. Just about the first house I lived in when I came to London, there were about four or five of us living in this house. It was about the only tape we had, and we used to wash up to it. I can remember that. Wash up and dry to it, obviously. And put away to it.
You're hand in hand beneath the trees, and soon there's music in the breeze. You're acting kind of smart until your heart just goes whap. Those trees that breeze, they're part of the tender trap.
Frank Sinatra with Count Basie and Love is the Tender Trap. Was it a major decision, Hugh Laurie, to say you were going to become an entertainer? I mean, I don't know what you were going to do with your degree in anthropology and been the threat of the Hong Kong police, but...
No, there was very little... In fact, there was no decision, really. In the final year at university, we did the show, which was... pretty successful, and a man with a Bentley and a long cigar, I mean, he's a real cliche, really, turned up from London and said, do you want to do this for a living? I didn't have a great stack of options at the time, and I thought, well, you know, it's worth giving it a go.
But you found yourself part of this group of very talented people, Emma Thompson and Stephen, obviously, and Tony Slattery, and then later on, as time went on, Rowan Atkinson and Robbie Coltrane. I'm sure it's difficult to look at yourselves objectively, but it's interesting that people come in waves, in groups like that, like Cleese and Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, came before you. Is there a kind of creative chemistry that gets going with such groups?
Yes, I suppose there must be. A sort of safety in numbers thing, apart from anything else, that people gain a sort of confidence from being around others, you know, sharing a load. Although some of the people you mentioned, I mean, Rowan Atkinson, I think of as a completely unique performer who sort of doesn't need anyone else, really. He's so utterly sort of self-contained in a way.
It's just that it seemed to be a kind of suddenly a whole swathe of you, sort of like... I mean,
yeah.
I suppose... as we eventually saw in the film Peter's Friends, you know,
all
of you all together, all incredibly talented, all individuals, and, you know, why do you come in gangs, I think, is the question.
I suppose there's a harvest of the comedy tree. And, of course, a lot of it is to do with what the Del Monte people, as it were, I'm continuing this harvest theme, what they're looking for at any given time, if they suddenly decide, yes, well, what we want is a sort of comedy, kind of 28 to 30-year-olds, get me six of them. You know, then you're in luck. And, of course, you know, 5 years later, it may be we need ballerinas. Ballerinas are in this year. It's all luck, really, isn't it?
Talking about Peter's Friends, though, when you made that film, it didn't go down well for some reason. You all made it together with Kenneth Branagh, and I don't know, it seemed to get up people's noses. Why was that? Because actually it was quite warm, touching. Well, I liked it.
Well, good. I think I can see why it got up people's noses. It appeared to represent a clique, and people are not surprisingly suspicious of cliques, hostile to cliques even.
But it represented what you were, what we're talking about. I mean,
well... Pretty inaccurately.
But there have been many successes since then, and indeed before Peter's Friends, and not least a little bit of Fry and Laurie and Blackadder for the BBC and some roles in the West End Theatre and so on. And you've just been making a remake of 101 Dalmatians with Glenn Close. So, I mean, you know, it's big time, really. Are you sure that acting isn't a good thing? Are you in the right profession, Hugh Laurie?
I don't know. I just don't know. I feel like it's never been tested. I don't know. I don't really know how much I love it, in a way. Perhaps I need to have my love for it tested more, so I will actually discover why I'm doing what I'm doing.
You don't think you're much cop at it, is that what you...
Well, no, not really, to be honest. Not really. I mean, I suppose I can do it better than some people, but then a lot worse than others. I think what I can do is do a large number of things sort of reasonably well. I can play the piano better than Stephen, but I can't play it as well as Jules Holland. But then I can probably act better than Jules Holland. But I can't act as well as Kenneth Branagh. But then I can maybe write a, you know... Who knows? And so it goes on. I can do a lot of things sort of reasonably well.
So what's the solution? Should you be stretched
suicide,
more?
Suicide, I think, probably. Is the
Well, you should either be stretched more or you should give it up.
Yes, all right. OK. That's a pretty blunt choice, but yes, I think of giving it up. But then everyone thinks of giving it, whatever they do, they think of giving it up and running away to the Seychelles or something.
Tell me about record number five.
Record number five is Ian Dury with a song called Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick, which I happen to believe is the second best pop song ever written.
I'm supposed to say what's the first.
You are supposed to say that. The answer is I don't know what the best pop song is. I just don't dare say that this is the best because you get people arguing with you and saying, are you out of your mind? Whereas no one's going to argue if you say it's the second best.
Why is this so good?
I just think it's witty and sexy and clever, and I think Ian Dury is an absolute genius.
Eskimo, Arapaho, move their body to and fro. Hit me with your rhythm stick. Hit me, das ist gut, say, fantastic. Hit me, hit me, hit me. Hit me with your rhythm stick. It's nice to be a lunatic. Hit me, hit me, hit me.
Ian Dury and Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. What was the first you knew, Hugh, about Stephen's disappearance from the West End, or, well, from London, from the world, really?
Our mutual agent informed me that, there was a problem. Very soon after that, I opened an envelope from Stephen. He'd written a number of letters to people saying, sort of explaining as best he could why he'd done what he'd done. And there we had it.
But did you ever think, like a lot of us thought, actually, that he'd committed suicide?
No, I didn't. I didn't. But then again, you know, you get superstitious about these things. And I thought I must not go about the place grandly asserting that I know Stephen and he would not do such a thing, because one gets superstitious. You think, I will be taught a lesson. And also because Stephen, I think, rather revels in doing the unpredictable thing, and in the frame of mind he was then in, that might have been enough to say, right, well, I'll show him. Hmm. Doesn't know me at all. Plop, so, off he goes off a bridge.
So how did you feel when finally he did turn up? I mean, how did you react? Did you feel sort of relieved or angry or what?
Just about the gamut. Actually, if gamuts, I think, are still things you run, and I ran it. Relief and joy and anger and worry, and can't think of any more, but there must be more, I'm sure.
But why do you think he did it? Did he do it for all the reasons we've been discussing, really, this kind of pressure and fear of failure?
You'd have to get him here in this chair to answer that. I mean, I can't speak for him. To be honest with you, I don't really know, even if he knows.
But did you...
It's difficult to answer for him.
No, quite, but... because of all the things you said about yourself, I wonder if you instinctively understood that fear of failure, which is what we've been talking about.
Most actors, if not all actors, can understand it, have sort of glimpsed that kind of monster of fear and complete panic.
Do you see less of him these days?
No, not really. I suppose it's true that we have done less work together. We haven't written together since then. And the writing together, that was what threw us together for sort of 10 hours a day. And we haven't done that. We are very good friends as well, and we have always been close. And I hope we'll always be.
He's godfather to your children.
Indeed. Indeed. Jolly good one, too. But it's actually when we make each other laugh, that is when we are about as close as you can get, really. You know?
But do you feel now that maybe the Fry and Laurie era is kind of over. Do you feel more on your own, really?
It's a lovely idea that there ever was such a thing as the Fryant Laurie era. I can't believe. But anyway, we're knocking on a bit now. We're now approaching the age where we could be junior cabinet ministers or all those sort of positions that you would want
indeed.
To... Or policemen, yeah. All those positions that you would want to mock in a sketch show. We are now sort of getting to that kind of time of our life when we could... It changes the whole thing.
So you have to do something else. You might have to do something...
Might have to do some work.
Yes. And you might have to be tested. And you might have to do something sort of more on your own, having really always been a team player.
Mm.
You're more on your own now.
Yes.
Does that worry you? Does that give you problems?
Well,
more than the usual problems. You know?
Well, yeah. I'm trying to look at it as a healthy thing, as a growing thing. I think, yes, it is. It's a bit scary. You know, I couldn't possibly deny that I've hidden behind Stephen a bit over the last 10, more than that, years. And that to come out from his shadow, and by God, it's a long one, is a slightly scary thing. But then I think it's a good thing. You know, one should be scared and one should stand alone and get shouted at and called a fraud. It's thoroughly healthy, I'm sure.
Just deeply demoralising. Record number 6.
This is an important piece of music, a very short piece of music, but basically it's impossible to be despondent to this music. This is the theme from The Seahawk, which was a wonderful Errol Flynn swashbuckling film, and the theme is by Eric Korngold, and don't half cheer you up.
Eric Korngold's theme music to the film The Seahawk. You've now written a novel, Hugh, called The Gunseller, a very funny novel, which apparently you sent to your publisher under a pseudonym. Why did you do that?
I think because I just wanted to get a sort of fair reaction that had nothing to do with my name, such as it is. So I sent it, I can't remember the name I sent it in, Gary Lineker or something plain like that that wouldn't make any difference.
You're obviously a fan of thrillers, because it's a thriller, and you obviously know a lot about motorbikes and guns, because there's a lot of those in it. A lot of comic irony, and it's occasionally very silly. Has it done anything for your self-confidence, having written it?
Well, first of all, it was tremendous fun. I mean, whether it was a good thing or bad thing for me to do, and let others be the judge of that, it was tremendous fun. I mean, I did just lose myself in this fantasy sort of heroic world of being the warrior hero. I do love thrillers. You know, some people have said that maybe there's a hint of parody in it, that I'm doing that I'm mocking the genre of thrillers, and that's not really the case, actually. Or at least if it is, I'm mocking something I love. I just get such pleasure from it, that sort of escapism.
Thank God you get pleasure from something, I think, because you obviously agonise.
That slipped out, yes. The whole thing comes tumbling down now, doesn't it?
How does your family put up with you? Wife and 3 children. Well, how old are the children?
They're 7, 5, and 2.5, and the half is very significant, of course.
Yeah. How do they put up with you? I mean, are you nice at home? I mean, do you make them laugh, or are you morose and gloomy?
I can still make the 5-year-old laugh. The 7-year-old's rather bored by me now and goes, "And Dad, you're only saying that just to make me laugh," and which is absolutely crushing. But that's how that's how I imagine audiences looking at me. "You're only saying that to make me laugh." It's pretty galling, actually. So I think I've lost him. He's grown out of me now.
And do you make your wife laugh, or does she have to put up with all the kind of agonising?
No, we make each other laugh. I mean, we do laugh a lot. We're jolly good chums. Oh, what a stupid thing to say. But you know what I mean? We do make each other laugh a lot.
Record number 7.
Well, talking of my wife, this is Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl. I'd love to be able to say that we heard this song while strolling through Venice, but that isn't the case. It's simply my wife has brown eyes and she is a girl. And that'll have to do as a reason.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rains came. Down in the hollow. Playing a new game. Laughing and running. Hey, hey. Skipping and jumping. In the misty morning fog with our hearts that thumping.
Van Morrison and Brown Eyed Girl. This is where you get to fantasize out loud. Tell me about Hugh Laurie on a desert island.
Quietly confident, actually, of my ability physically to survive, to sort of do the binding of coconut fronds. I don't know if coconuts have fronds, but that must be one of the first things I would try and discover. And as I say, I just have this such a wonderfully intense fantasy life that I would be able to visit many far-off continents inside my own head, actually, without any problem. In fact, I think I'm really rather looking forward to it in some ways.
And family apart, what will you miss most of the life that you have at the present?
I suppose the company of one's friends and motorcycles I will miss a great deal. That would be a bitter blow. If I was there for long enough, I might try and make one. And I suppose musical instruments, actually, rather than the records, a piano would be a wonderful thing to have and to have the wherewithal. But then, of course, one can manufacture these things one way or another. Conch shells. I don't know where this island is. I assume it's outside the M25 somewhere. If conch shells are lying around on the beach. If there is a beach, maybe a car park.
Last record.
This is Dr. John with a very, very sad record called Me Minus You Equals Loneliness.
And why do you want that?
Because I do enjoy sadness. I like a bit of a wallow. I'm very happy when I'm sad.
What do we equal loneliness?
What do you want to be? What do we
good than me?
What do you want to
manage you? Equal loneliness.
Dr. John and Me Minus You Equals Loneliness. Not good for morale, you think, on central.
Well, maybe not. Maybe not. But then I think if you listen to the Eric Korngold straight afterwards, that would cheer you right back up.
And if you could only take one of them?
I would have to take Brown Eyed Girl, I think. And failing that, I'd have to take the record called Brown Eyed Girl.
And your book?
I think I would like to learn Italian. The trouble is that, of course, all Italian, teach yourself Italian books boast about how quickly you can do it. But on a desert island, you'd want learn Italian incredibly slowly, if there is such a volume. I don't think any fiction would really bear that sort of repetition, but I'd love to learn Italian.
And your luxury?
Ideally, it would be the Savoy Hotel, but I have a feeling that would be
difficult.
You wouldn't allow that. No. I think my luxury would have to be a photo album, obviously with photographs in it, because an album on its own would be sort of dull, containing photographs of my family, my brown-eyed girl, just a collection of everyone I've known and loved, really. I don't know, I have no idea how long that would be. Maybe a big one.
Hugh Laurie, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.